seconds. The countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. And it is Saturday once again, the 23rd of December in the glorious future year of 2023. Only one more show before I have to change to saying 2024. Sheesh! Well, it may be the glorious future year of 2023, but if you look around you in this world, it doesn't seem as though people are acting like it. But considering the time of year, considering what day this is, you know, tomorrow is Christmas Eve, the day after that is Christmas, unless you're Rolly, in which case it's already Christmas Eve for you, but I mean, you know, speaking in UTC terms. What I have to talk about today, as much as anything, I'm going to defer the discussion of the fiasco at the British Library and all manner of other things. I'm going to defer those to another day. Maybe next week, maybe the week after that. And instead I'm going to talk about peace on earth, goodwill toward men. And the first thing I'm going to read to you is a poem by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, the American poet, perhaps most famous for his epic Song of Hiawatha, which is cast in the same kind of verse as the Finnish national epic, the Kalevala. Kalevala? I'm never really quite sure where to put the how to pronounce that. Anyway, but which many people find just absolutely crushingly monotonous. By the shores of Gitche-Gumee, by the shining Big Sea waters, stood the wigwam of Nokomis, daughter of the moon Nokomis, and so on for, you know, 20,000 lines. But Longfellow wrote this poem in the middle of the American Civil War, the war between the states, the War of the Rebellion. Some folks still call it the War of Northern Aggression, although mostly tongue-in-cheek, I hope. I heard the bells on Christmas Day their old familiar carols play, and wild and sweet the words repeat of peace on earth, goodwill to men, and thought how, as the day had come, the belfries of all Christendom had rolled along the unbroken song of peace on earth, goodwill to men, till, ringing, singing on its way, the world revolved from might till, ringing, singing on its way, the world revolved from night to day, a voice, a chime, a chant sublime, of peace on earth, goodwill to men. Then, from each black accursed mouth, the cannon thundered in the south, and with the sound of the carols drowned of peace on earth, goodwill to men. It was as if an earthquake rent the hearthstones of a continent, and made forlorn the households born of peace on earth, goodwill to men. And in despair I bowed my head. There is no peace on earth, I said, for hate is strong, and mocks the song of peace on earth, goodwill to men. Then pealed the bells more loud and deep. God is not dead, nor doth he sleep. The wrong shall fail, the right prevail, with peace on earth, goodwill to men. And when we look at the world around us, my goodness, how much we need the hope and confidence that the destructive impulses and the selfish impulses shall not overwhelm us, destroy us, consume everything that we value. We must have hope. We must have confidence. Well, I'm going to go back 2,500 years or so and read another poem, a very short one. This is from a collection of verse of disputed origin known as Homeric hymns. Some of them are long, some of them are short. Some of them, it's thought, may have been meant as preludes to be recited before reciting a section of an epic such as the Iliad or the Odyssey. They are archaic, in any case. You know, the oldest works, literary works that we have in the West, which are reasonably well attributable as to author, there's the Works and Days of Hesiod. That's about it. You know, Homer is perhaps contemporary with, perhaps a little earlier than Hesiod, but there are still some people who doubt that there ever was such a person as Homer. Now, it seems almost certain that the poetry attributed to Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey, was not necessarily in the form we have it now. The manuscripts all have variations, and there are some people who refer this to a corrupted text, but it's much more likely that there were many oral traditions which propagated the work of Homer, or some people call the Homer poet, and it's like, Jesus, just call him Homer, or the Homer poets, as though there were a circle, which there might have been, but sort of the simplest explanation is that there was a Homer, who was a great oral poet, and his compositions on material of the Iliad and the Odyssey were carried down through oral tradition and transcribed when writing began to enter the ascendant in the Greek world. Anyway, suffice to say that the authorship of the so-called Homeric hymns, sometimes attributed to Homer, sometimes attributed to others. There is, in fact, one in which the text of the poem indicates that there was a particular rhapsode who is responsible, at least for the version we have. None of that is particularly important right now, but I'm going to read you number 20 to Hephaestus in a non-poetic English translation. Sing, clear-voiced muse of Hephaestus, famed for inventions. With bright-eyed Athena, he taught men glorious crafts throughout the world, men who before used to dwell in caves in the mountains like wild beasts. But now that they have learned crafts through Hephaestus, the famed worker, easily they live a peaceful life in their own houses the whole year round. Be gracious, Hephaestus, and grant me success and prosperity. And the reason I'm not going to read it to you in the original Greek, firstly, is that you probably wouldn't understand a word of it. A, because it's in Homeric Greek, and B, because my Greek diction isn't great, you know. Hephaiston clutometin aiseio musa legeia. Ous met hathenais. Ους μετ Αθέναις γλαουκόπιδος αγλαί εργα ανθρωπος εδιδαισεις επιχθονος οι το παρος πέρ. Anyway, you don't want me to do any more of that. But I will read you a little bit here from the Allen and Sykes Commentary on the Homeric Hymns, which remarks, The fact that Hephaestus and Athena were joined in a common cult at Athens, and as far as is known, in no other Greek city, gives color to Baumeister's suggestion that this hymn is Athenian. The two deities were worshipped together as patrons of all arts and crafts. The shops of braziers and ironmongers were near the temple of Hephaestus, in which stood a statue of Athena, and the festival called Chalkeia was sacred to both, Chalkeia meaning something like working in bronze. According to Plato's Critias, Athena and Hephaestus, Philosophia Philotechnia Teepita Auta Elfontes, became joint patrons of Attica, referring to Solon and other references. Athena was addressed as Ergane, the worker, but in a wider sense she was the giver of all civilization. Hephaestus, the fire god and the divine smith, gave men the skill. Clutometin, line 1, Clutotechnein, line 5, which differentiated them from wild beasts. Aeschylus, indeed, attributes these gifts of civilization to Prometheus, but the importance of the Titan was mainly mythological. In practical cult, Hephaestus appropriated much of the credit. But this aspect of Athena and Hephaestus was by no means exclusively Attic. Athena was the patron of arts in Homer, and under such titles as Ergane, Kaliergos, and Machanitis. She was worshipped in many parts of Greece. In Hesiod, she instructs Pandora, the creation of Hephaestus, in weaving. We may therefore fairly look for epic rather than Athenian influence in the mythology of this hymn. Sing, clear-voiced muse of Hephaestus, famed for inventions. With bright-eyed Athena he taught men glorious crafts throughout the world, men who before used to dwell in caves in the mountains like wild beasts. But now that they have learned crafts through Hephaestus, the famed worker, easily they live a peaceful life in their own houses the whole year round. Be gracious, Hephaestus, and grant me success and prosperity. And that last line gives one the indication that it was probably an invocation meant to precede the recitation of some longer poem or something. Of course, it could just as easily be meant as a poem or a prayer to be recited by the smith before he goes to his forge to work for the day, something like a grace before meals. Anyhow. But what does all this have to do with itself? Right? What am I really trying to say here? Well, the first thing is that I want to bring you to a consciousness, as it were, of the immense powers that mankind now wields for good or ill. And of course that is something I talk about a lot, so you shouldn't be at all surprised when I say that. The immense powers that man now wields for good or ill. And that it is our responsibility as civilized people, as people working, I think, who are obligated to make the best use of what we have received. Some would say from the gods, some would say from nature, some would say from nature and also from preceding generations of human beings. Right. However you look at it, I feel we are obligated to make the best and highest use of these powers that we possess, not to destroy one another, but to aid one another, and in the end to become more than we are. And that, I think, is the key concept. That, as the Homeric hymn says, technology, right, skill in the arts, the ability to make tools and use tools to make things that we need, that is what makes us, in some way, different from the beasts of the field. That, as it is said, perish and they are gone. So Hephaestus is here. He's not praised as the maker of the weapons of Zeus, right, or the armor of Achilles, or any of those things. No, he is praised as the one who teaches us skills by which we can better live. And that's all, you know, and that's the thing, is that this Homeric hymn 20 in praise of, or addressed to Hephaestus, is the only verse. There are some gods and goddesses in the list who have several hymns. There's long hymns to Apollo and Aphrodite and Demeter, but Hephaestus gets only this short verse, and what it says is, you teach us skills by which we live better. And that, to me, is very powerful. It's a thing to meditate on. But what else is there to say? Well, I continue to think about Aristotle of Stagira, who is so important to our modern world in many ways. Now, of course, coming up very soon is December 25th, which is the birthday of Isaac Newton. And I always say, you know, we must commemorate the birth centuries ago of someone whose thinking and writing and teaching became the foundation of everything we do in the world today. Because, of course, it's Newton who brings us true quantitative thinking. It's Newton who brings us the habit, instills in us the habit of considering nature in a quantitative and numerical aspect. And of course there are problems that arise from that, particularly the people, small-minded people, who, if they can't measure something easily, it doesn't exist, and what they can measure easily is the only thing that exists. But Newton taught us to understand the world in terms of quantities and their interactions. You know, and of course, key to that is the calculus. But Aristotle of Stagira is also a key contributor to the thought that makes our world. Because, of course, Newton's mathematical thought is very much empiricist. And Aristotle is sort of the grandfather of empiricism as we know it, because Aristotle's, you know, I mean, Plato was idealistic. In other words, he saw all things that exist in the world as merely dim reflections of some true existence in some further plane, whereas Aristotle was dubious about this concept of Platonic forms and insisted that there was, so far as the forms exist in our minds, they exist as abstractions from the things that we observe in the world. And then this concept was taken on by Albertus Magnus and his pupil Thomas Aquinas. Right, Aquinas, gifted with the belief in the solidity and rationality of the world that came with his deep Christian faith, which is something that Aristotle didn't have, right? Aristotle did not have a sense of the origins of the cosmos. He did not have a sense of the stability of the cosmos. You know, most philosophical and religious traditions look at the world in which we exist and see it as a place of change and instability, of things coming into being, of things passing out of existence, things becoming other things. And so, for example, it's on this basis that Buddhism, which has close ties at its roots to classical Greek philosophy, in particular the philosophy of the Cynics, which contains statements which, allowing for the difference between Attic Greek and Sanskrit, are word for word identical, that Aquinas believes that the world is real in a very fundamental sense. Not that it's ultimately real, the ultimate reality is God, but that God has chosen to endow this universe with reality. You know, whereas the Buddhists, for example, will tell you that all is Maya, which can be translated variously as illusion, deception. What they mean is, I think, I mean, I'm not the Buddhist on this show, but the fundamental Buddhist doctrine is that you can't depend on the world to keep existing. You can't depend on anything in the world. You know, you look away and you look back and everything has changed. It's very much related, you know, to the, again, threads of classical Greek philosophy, which say, you know, you can never step in the same river twice. You know, Heraclitus, the fundamental principle of everything is fire, by which he means change. The universe is fundamentally unstable, unreliable, undependable, not something you can, well, not something that you can observe and have your observations have enough meaning that systematic observation can tell you anything that's true. And, you know, and so this is why, as has often been said, the classical Chinese, for all of their learning and erudition, never developed something like biological taxonomy, and their depictions of animals in art are always odd. And the reason is that in Taoism and Buddhism, it's generally understood that the world is a place of flux and uncertainty. And so the idea of sitting down with a pair of calipers and measuring the length of the thorax of an insect, for example, and then another one, and then another one, and then another one, until you have measured thousands of insects, which you think are all the same kind of insect, and you have some idea of what the size of their thorax is, this never occurred to them because they didn't consider the world to be a stable place, a place that you could rely on to be there when you look at it a second time. And so, of course, if that's the nature of the world, then you can't you learn anything meaningful and useful by the inductive method. But Aristotle is the father or grandfather of modern science in that sense, perhaps great-grandfather. If Newton is the one who gives us science in the sense of formalized quantitative tools for doing inductive reasoning, and Aquinas is the one who gives us the confidence that looking at the world, understanding the world, is a way to get knowledge that's actually knowledge, then we back up a further step, and Aristotle, you know, to a great extent, inspires the, and I won't claim Aquinas as an empiricist, right? That's going too far. But he thought that observing the world could give you true, if limited, right, limited in scope, but true information from which you could reason. Anyway, why do I keep talking about Aristotle of Stagira? Well, again, because of his importance, but also because I keep coming back. You know, the thing is, Aristotle is not entirely a Greek. Stagira was an Ionian colony in Macedonia, and so its people were sort of in the gray zone. The Macedonians themselves were very much in the gray zone, sometimes referred to as Greeks, sometimes as barbarians. So the people of Stagira were kind of in this gray zone between Greeks, Hellenes, and barbarians. And so Aristotle, residing at Athens, I think, is conscious of a certain inferiority, social inferiority, which always makes me think of that great novel of South Africa, Cry the Beloved Country, which is told from the viewpoint of a black African Anglican minister, right? And neither he nor the author, right, thinks that he's less of a human being or something like that because he's not white. But on the other hand, he is always conscious of a what I would call a social inferiority, in the sense that, you know, the railway he travels on was not built by people from the culture he came from, right? The cities he goes to are not built by the people of the culture he came from, or if they were, it was only as laborers under the direction of people from some other culture. And the very written language that he uses, right, in his Bible reading and so on, was not created by people from the culture he comes from. So there's the sometimes referred to as the missionary schoolboy phenomenon, where someone who is conscious of this, what we might call social inferiority, comes back to his native place and tries to completely do away with the culture there and replace it with the culture that he's learned. And so there's a sort of adhesion, and in the same way, I think, you know, Aristotle is constantly trying to prove that the culture of the Athenians is the best, not of the Macedonians, and not of Stagira, where he comes from, but of Athens. And so he wrote a whole volume, you know, on the constitution of Athens. And everywhere you look in his writings, you know, he's holding up the Athenians as the great example of how to do things. And so, you know, there's, as is well known in his volume, The Politics, he defends slavery. And why does he defend it? Well, my impression is that he defends it because the Athenians do it, and therefore it can't be unjust. It can't be wrong, because the Athenians do it, and the Athenians are you know, have the best institutions of anyone. But the whole text of his defense of slavery reads very much as motivated reasoning. You know, he spends a lot of effort to prove that some people are fitted by nature to be slaves. You know, C.S. Lewis's retort to that, of course, was, but who is fitted by nature to be master? But the obvious thing is that he doesn't go to any effort, because I don't think he could, I don't think anyone could, to prove that the people who are actually enslaved are the same as these natural slaves. But the thing that makes it, I think, very obvious that all of this is motivated reasoning is that he gets to the end of the section and he says, basically, that of course if machines could be made to go by themselves, then there would be no rationale for slavery and it would disappear, right? While he's spent so much time saying, well, slavery is just in consequence of nature because some people are naturally slaves, then he says, then he gets to the end and says that there's an instrumental reason for slavery, which he never really did mention, that it's not just a fact of human nature, and that if the instrumental reason were to go away, then the fact would wither away as well. But this is, this I think is very important. I keep thinking, again, to loop back to the beginning, to the poem I read at the beginning, that the outcome of the American Civil War was the triumph of the masters of steam engines over the masters of slaves. This is not the same as liberation, right? This does not accomplish liberation, but it is a necessary step toward liberation. What does liberation look like? We don't know yet because we haven't got it, but we've made steps, more steps in some parts of the world than others. And it is incumbent upon us to continue making further steps towards liberation, even if we don't really know what it is. We don't know what it looks like. Liberation and peace. Peace on earth, goodwill towards men. Liberation and peace. Peace on earth, goodwill towards men. Anyway, send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. And thank you to the SDF Public Access Unix System for sponsoring Anon Radio. Up next on Anon Radio is Tobe with the Dubious Goals Committee, which...